This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Whatever you seek, whoever you are, there's a place for you here. Our doors are open. Our tables are set. This is Boston, and we are all inclusive.
That's some sound from All Inclusive Boston, the city's campaign begun under former interim mayor Kim Janey. The goal? Reimagine how Boston is perceived locally and across the globe. Current Boston Mayor Michelle Wu has doubled down. She's hired a night czar and recently announced John Borders IV as her new director of tourism, sports, and entertainment. According to the City of Boston's website, John's job includes supporting, quote, the tourism industry in Boston by producing events, supporting film and TV production, and marketing the city to conventions and visitors, end quote. It's a big job. So how's he going to do it? Well, John's here in Studio 2. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's have a little fun to start. What is your favorite thing to do in Boston?
It's a great question. My favorite thing to do in Boston, I'm going to be biased, taking a Seas game.
Celtics game.
I'm an avid sports fan. I really, really love that we are known as a sports town. I think there's an opportunity to engage so many different people in arts and music and culture and food. And I think those are things that bring people together, especially sports. So having had a background, a little bit of time working with the Boston Celtics, I'm very, very biased when it comes to those green guys.
It's kind of nice to be able to embrace that bias.
Yeah. I can lean into it now. It's like, oh, where are you from? Boston. Oh, yeah. You know, we get to talk about it. So, and the guys are playing really well right now. So shout out to the Seas.
Are we accessible? You know, Revs, Sox, Celtics, Boston Pride. Are we accessible on the sports front? And should we be doing more there?
That's a great question. I think the answer is yes. But there's always room to do more. Until as we use equity as the North Star, I think there's always opportunities to bring in more people. And whether that be a lot of different clubs and organizations are doing great work around having different nights where they're focused on different groups, whether it's a Pride night, whether it's, you know, this type of month or that type of month where they're really amplifying different voices. I think there's always more that can be done there, but I think we're well on our way.
How do you do tourism, sports, and entertainment, and I'm thinking also movies and TV, with this equity focus, this equity anchor as the guiding light? What looks different because you do that?
It's a great question. I think we start by understanding what the landscape was and understanding what is going on now and what can be. So I think a lot of it has to do with access. I have a tattoo on my wrist of a skeleton key. Access means so much to me. I think you have the ability to unlock and create opportunity all across the board. So I think by streamlining access and those entry points and giving people opportunities that they typically would not have, we're in the process of continuing to engage our relationship with Boston Neighborhood Network and something in terms of low-hanging fruit. I remember being a kid in the city of Boston and watching BNN and watching local sports, watching English High School play Snowden on Channel 3 and, you know, remembering those days. And I'm like, we need to actively work to bring back that game of the week and give kids who are working in these after-school programs and they are part of the AV club locally, give them opportunities to learn how to edit, learn, you know, how to work these cameras and tripods. You know, you have TikTok as the number one app in the world, but then you have kids who are able to create content. And how do we move those into career pathing for them? How do we give them opportunities where they're actually out shooting content, cutting, and then, you know, kind of moving into these, you know, comms roles and getting internship opportunities? So I think as we think of the lens of the international, the national, and then local, we start locally. And what does it mean for us to lean into the amazing things that we're already doing here in the city? So I think that's where we're starting.
We're speaking with John Borders IV, who's the new director of tourism, sports, and entertainment for the city. Let's stay in film and TV for a minute.
Go for it.
We've done a series here on Radio Boston called Set in Boston about films that we were either about or made in Boston. We've done everything from Blue Hill Avenue to The Departed.
Yeah.
there's a long tradition, healthy maybe not, but there is a long tradition sort of Boston being known in film and television as white, Southie Charlestown, bank robbing, mafia Boston.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the reasons we did Blue Hill Avenue was to take a different look.
Yeah.
That's part of your purview. So one, how do you attract stories and films that tell the whole story of Boston? And two, do you actually have to shut down a little bit of the other stuff in order to, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, whatever the next Dennis Lehane book movie is going to be.
Yeah. I think that's I'm going to keep saying it. These are good questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're doing well. I'm still 6 weeks into my role.
Yeah.
So I'll start there. And again, gathering information and understanding who wants to come to Boston and why. I do think our office will have some control over what films here and what doesn't. But I think we also want to give people opportunities to, as you shared, see Boston in different lights. So it's not just, you know, old white Charlestown, you know, mob ties, kind of, you know, bank robbery films. And that's not the only view of Boston. Boston currently is 51% BIPOC. Boston is 21% Black. You would not know that if you were not here. Like, so how do we amplify those voices? How do we give people access to seeing Boston in a different lens? And I think the all-inclusive campaign, the award-winning all-inclusive campaign, is a great start. But what are, again, the different opportunities that we have to allow people to see what that looks like? When I think of even the tourism lens, we're coming up on Restaurant Week, where you have a two-week window where people are typically taking in their favorite restaurants. Why don't we put out a challenge to the entire city saying, we challenge you to go eat in a neighborhood that you've never been to? If you're from Brighton, go to Mattapan. If you're from Dorchester, go to South Boston. Like, you would not, like, we have to challenge people to move around and really take in this city and to get out of their comfort zones. Because I think as segregated as this city has been, there's a new opportunity. There's a new pulse of the city. There's a new tenor, if you would, of what the city has to offer. And people are now starting to kind of push up against that. I mean, as the colloquialism would say, you know, we're outside right now. People are excited to be back out. So what does that movement mean? You got to get beyond your neighborhood. You got to get beyond your comfort zone and start having these, you know, ugly, honest conversations and kind of moving past that and seeing what the city has to offer. And there's so much here. There's so much here. So I think to your earlier point about the films, I think it's cool to show what Boston has been. Absolutely. This is what Boston was known for. But I think if we stop there, we're doing ourselves a disservice. There's so much more that the city has to offer.
So I want to hit two rate limiting factors here. And the first one, so we reached out to our texting group, asked them, what do you want to see more of? And if you want to join that texting group, you text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's Boston to 617-766-0382. Luke from Boston brought back to us what we always hear when we talk about what's possible in Boston. Boston should have the T run 24/7 mm-hmm. for safely getting around at night, and there should be more 18-plus clubs. My emphasis, less on the 18-plus clubs today, more on the T. It is a rate-limiting factor. Do you have influence there? Are you building a relationship with the MBTA? How do you work on that lever?
That's a great question. We are in the process of exploring any and all opportunities for what, as our mayor would say, Boston to be a 24-hour city. So we know that we have to have the T working and working at the highest level. So the essence of our infrastructure, some of that has to do with city resources. Some of that has to do with state government, and some will have to do with even at the national and federal level, what that support looks like. We know that we have the oldest, the first mobile transit in the nation. So that is something that we tout. That's something that we champion. We were the first to say, this is how you get around. This is how you do it from a communal aspect. Do we have upgrades that need to happen? Of course, that's going to take place, and it is taking place. But yes, there is an opportunity to do more in this city. Shout out to Luke, 18 plus clubs. I'll be working closely with the late night czar, my colleague Corrine Reynolds, who will be leaning into what that looks like. But we're exploring any and all opportunities of what that looks like, because it's not just the 18 plus clubs, but I have three children. So what does it mean to be out with your family at night and take in experiences? How can we, you know, our mayor is really big on making this a family-friendly city. So what does that look like when you go out and you want to, you know, take in a meal and go to the movies with your kids or go bowling or do this or that? Like, there are so many different other opportunities. So how can we explore these different spaces and really take advantage of that? So I think there's a whole lot of exploration right now, and we are depending on the community. So please, I look forward to getting these text messages that you have to share and answering these questions offline. I'm all about it, because we need the community input.
We can't do this by ourselves.
Yeah.
And just a couple highlights for you. An annual Boston area bike tour. Ty in Boston said, model one after the five borough bike tour in New York. Westy in Boston said, how about a sculpture exhibit? We'll give you the rest of them too.
Let's do it.
So listen, the other rate limiting factor, you don't have authority over the Massachusetts Convention Center Authority.
Not at all.
But I know you're responsible for conventions. You're responsible for collaborating with them. Diana DiZoglio, the auditor, has just launched an audit. There was a report in the Boston Globe that five employees have filed complaints about racism. Attracting a diverse group of tourists and conventions can be tough when that's the reputation. How are you thinking about that in your role?
Great question. I think it's starting with, again, uncovering what has been. So for those complaints to come out, for people to be able to speak out and say, we feel that there were some discriminatory practices that were in place. If that be true, if that be the case, then let's rid ourselves of that. That does not, these one-offs do not represent all of what Boston has to offer. So again, the unfortunate part is, you know, if that, and I don't know all the details of the case, so I'm not going to be able to speak directly to it in that regard. But if these things, how do we destigmatize what Boston was?
Yeah.
We continue to amplify what Boston is. So being able to create space for the Boston Wild Black, being able to create space for the all-inclusive campaign, being able to amplify amazing people doing great work already. There are so many different Black-owned businesses that are even starting to pop up and really lean in. I'm not trying to amplify certain people. I recently went to the Hugh restaurant in the Copley area, which is, you know, minority owned as well. So you have an opportunity to take in these different experiences and see a different Boston. As we continue to draw and attract different conventions that have, you know, typically shied away from what Boston is, the only way they'll see that they have an option to come to Boston is to show what Boston is. So it's not just the convention center, but what does the city have to offer that would draw us here? What does the city have to offer that would attract us? And I think we can compete with the best of them when it comes to those things.
So how important is a really successful NAACP convention this summer here in Boston?
Extremely important. And we want your input. We want your feedback. We want you to come out. There are going to be so many different people from all these different parts of the country seeing Boston in a new light. I don't want to tell too much, but we're actually in the process of moving Gospel Fest, which typically takes place on a Sunday in August. We're moving it up to be a part of that NAACP weekend. There are different things. I can't tell too many things, but just stay tuned. NAACP weekend is going to be amazing, and I think there are a lot of really cool things. We will put our best foot forward as a city to show off who we are when the NAACP convention comes to town.
All right, John Borders IV is the new Director of Tourism, Sports, and Entertainment at the City of Boston. Will you come back and talk to us again?
I promise. Thank you so much for the opportunity. This was great.
Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Newly elected State Auditor Diana DiZoglio ran on a platform of aggressive oversight, and now she's following through. Included on her list, auditing the Massachusetts State Legislature. The question is, can she audit the legislature, and how much will the legislature cooperate? Here to tell us more, WBUR Senior State House Reporter Steve Brown. Steve, welcome.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Steve, briefly, this is one of three audits that she's announced in the last 2 weeks. The other, the audit of the MBTA operations and safety practices and the Massachusetts Convention Center Authority after multiple employees filed complaints about racism in the last several weeks. Is that a lot right out of the gate?
Well, it is ambitious, that's for sure. As a legislator, DiSoglio never really shied away from tackling controversial issues. Those are those issues that might raise the hackles of the powers that be. This certainly is doing that. Some may question whether she's just seeking the limelight, but, you know, the tea in the convention center have been in the headlines quite a bit lately. They're fair game for examination, and she's not kicking anything down the road.
All right, so I want to focus on the legislature audit. She is moving to audit them. That is rare. My understanding is the last time there was an audit of the legislature was about 100 years ago. Why do this and why now?
Well, 101 years, to be exact. The legislature really discourages anyone looking into their inner workings. They say they're open. You can see their sessions on video. They stream them live, and you can look at the journals and things like that. They say they're open, but when you start asking questions about, you know, the inner workings, they're a little more cagey about that. But the understanding has been that the only changes that outside forces can make with the legislature is when the voters go to the polls every 2 years. You don't like what the legislature's doing? Well, vote them out. That's easier said than done, but that is the remedy. So it people haven't really been looking down at what the legislature does, how it operates, and there have been reports of things that people raise questions about.
So there is a legal question, I think, here, Steve. DiSoglio's predecessor was Suzanne Bump. She served as auditor from 2011 to 2023. And my understanding is she actually didn't believe that the auditor's office had the authority to audit the legislature.
Yeah, that's right. She said that she looked into the issue when she was first elected, and according to a statement that was issued by her office at that time, the enabling statute of the auditor's office grants her the authority to audit more than 200 executive branch agencies. But Bump's statement added that the legislature is not among that list. Therefore, the Office of the State Auditor, by law, does not have the authority, expressed or implied, to audit the legislature. Now, that was Suzanne Bump's take. Obviously, her successor has a different viewpoint.
And are there others who agree with DiSoglio? So my understanding is that Bump's basically saying, if it's not on the list, we can't. And there's some counterargument that is, it's not excluded off the list. It's just not there. So maybe we can't.
Yeah, I've been reading through the Mass General Laws and the Massachusetts Constitution, and you know, I'm not a lawyer by any stretch of the imagination or anything. So there are a lot of questions to be answered as to whether or not she has the authority to do it. It's kind of up in the air, and I'm eager to see how this is going to play out.
Could we see a legal battle, Steve?
We very much could. Right now she's encouraging the legislature to cooperate. We're looking forward to cooperating with you and doing this audit for the good of the state and everything. So she's using the carrot right now. She may have to go to the stick, and that would be if the legislature says no, we're not going to give you any of this information. You don't have authority to look into this. This is a violation of the Constitution. What I'm hearing now is that, look at Article 30 of the state Constitution. It basically is the separation of powers. It basically says that the executive won't get involved with the legislative branch. And, you know, I think it will take some lawyers to sort out whether or not the auditor's office falls under executive. There is a lot of unanswered questions here. Depends on who you ask. And so ultimately, this could wind up in court.
We're talking with WBUR senior state house reporter Steve Brown about the move by newly elected auditor Diana DiSoglio to attempt to audit a lot of big parts of state government, including the legislature. I do want to get to the Convention Center Authority and the T in just a minute, Steve. But before we move off of the state legislature, you've got an office in the state house. What are you hearing there?
Believe it or not, the legislature right now has, for the most part, been ignoring it. There's been no statement from the Speaker's office. A spokesperson for the Senate president issued the most defiant statement just the other night when news of this audit came out. That statement noted that, quote, under the Massachusetts Constitution, and as the separation of powers clause dictates, the Senate is required to manage its own business and set its own rules. So I think that's a polite way of telling DiSoglio to butt out.
All right. Let's look to a couple of the other places. First, the T. She has said that she is going to audit the operations, not the financials, but the operations and the safety measures, the safety practices of the MBTA. Is there authority there to do that? She was clear she wanted to do this when she ran for the office.
Yeah, this is more clear cut. There are so many audit reports that come out, and a lot of them are kind of sleepy and not too exciting. Different agencies that the auditor's office is supposed to look into every few years. Depends on the scope of the audit. Now, she obviously is not just looking at the finances of the MBTA. She wants to see how it works and how people are hired and all those kind of things. So that's getting way into it. And the T is a hot button issue. There's no doubt about that. Seems every day there's something else going wrong there and it winds up in the news. She sees her office as having the responsibility to look at what's going on at the T from stem to stern.
So GBH ran some reporting, and Brian Kane, the executive director of the MBTA Advisory Board, talked to them and said, what the T doesn't need right now is more people coming in and telling them what they're not doing. Have you heard any exasperation over, listen, there's already been a federal report, there's already been a ton of oversight here, this is a distraction?
I haven't heard anything personally, but that quote from Mr. Kane, nobody likes anybody looking over your shoulder. That's human nature. That doesn't surprise me. But again, with all the things that have been going on with the MBTA, another look from somebody else might not be a bad idea.
All right, so last question for you. We've talked about the T. We've talked about the state legislature. Earlier in the hour, we spoke with the head of tourism for the city of Boston. We talked about the fact that she is auditing the Massachusetts Convention Center Authority after several employees there filed complaints about racism and racist practices. That's a lot of work. Is her department big enough? Is there the staff there to do all of this and do it right? Any sense on that?
Yeah, I had asked the auditor's office. I got an email response back. It says that under our current operating budget of $22,776,302, to be exact, auditors work on several audits all at the same time and have already begun work on these issues.
All right, WBUR Senior State House Reporter Steve Brown catching us up on a flurry of activity out of the state auditor's office over the last 2 weeks. Great to talk to you as always, Steve. Thanks.
Good talking with you, Tiziana.
What's your favorite book? You got that dog-eared copy somewhere around the house? Do you have it on your iPad or phone or somewhere digitally too? Because if you do, you might turn to your favorite page or passage and see something different, new words, new sentences. That's because digital copyright holders can change the content of a digital book. The issue recently came to light after the digital publisher of Roald Dahl books started changing some of the language in UK versions. Now, our focus is not on the Dahl books or whether you agree with specific language changes. It's this question of the right to make those changes in an artistic work in the first place, and what such rights could mean in an increasingly digital world. Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray has been writing about this, joins us now for Tech Talk. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you very much. And I love the way you put that. That was a beautiful introduction, because that's exactly what's on the table here.
So pick it up, Hiawatha, and take it away.
Well, no, you see, the funny thing about it is that this is a whole controversy over who actually owns the ideas in a book. And you would think it had almost been settled I think in the early 20th century, there was actually a Supreme Court case over this because book publishers in the United States were trying to stop people from selling used books. They were saying, those are our books. We have the copyright. You can't do it. The Supreme Court said, no. You can control the content of the book, but the physical object itself belongs to who bought it, which is why you have used bookstores. You can go and you can sell a copy of your book, but you do not own the stuff in the book, the actual ideas, expressions. That's copyrighted. You can't make a copy of it and sell it yourself.
But
Everything starts to change when books become digital. That's what changes the whole thing. Because first of all, when they started selling digital books like with Amazon Kindle, they built into the system what's known as digital rights management. Because, you know, the major problem with digital books is you can make infinite copies of them, right? Any place where there's digital books, there are rules and actually built into the software in place to limit what you can do with them. Like public libraries. Have you ever noticed you can now rent ebooks from your public library?
Yes.
But under a contract that requires them to only issue so many books, it can only be viewed on an app that has it locked in, so you can't make a copy of it, you can't cut and paste, you can't do anything. They control that digital book. And now we're raising an entirely new level of concern, because if they can control the digital book, they can also control what's in it. And that means that it turns out a publisher or a copyright holder of a digital book can actually make post publication changes in the book. And there's not a whole lot you can do about it. And they have the right to do it.
So,
they do.
So in this world where more and more all of our art is digital, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about NFTs and music. And are we seeing a world where there's a difference between, you know, the artists? So, let's go back in time, right? Imagine John Lennon writes Imagine. Right. Mm-hmm. And now we fast forward. It's on Spotify. I don't even know anymore who owns the digital right to the Beatles, but mm-hmm. somebody does.
Right.
They could literally change the lyrics of Imagine, or is this only books right now? I mean, what kind of rabbit hole are we talking about?
Well, obviously, in theory, they could change the music. I mean, it would be very hard to do. You'd have to figure out some way to do it and make it sound like John Lennon and all. In that case, I think people would freak. I just don't know. I'm glad you brought that up, because I hadn't thought about it. I can't imagine anyone sitting still for changing a familiar song. And we've already seen what happens when you change a familiar book. In the case of a book, though, it's going to be subtler. If somebody changes the melody to Imagine, a song which, by the way, I really don't like. I've never liked that song. But never mind.
Oh, and I should note, by the way, that one technically might not have been the Beatles. That might have just been John Lennon. Somebody out there is going crazy I equated
those. I am not a fan of that song. Never mind. But in any case, it would be immediately obvious that song's entirely different. But if you change a few words of a book, it probably isn't going to set off as many alarm bells. What happened in this case was they told everybody that they were doing it, and fans of one of the best-selling children's authors on earth were furious about it. And I had to add this to my story in the last minute, because here's a fascinating illustration of how crazy it is. R.L. Stine, the creator of Goosebumps, the hugely successful horror stories for children, it turns out that his publisher, Scholastic, started making changes in his books back in 2018. And this week, he responded with stunned outrage on Twitter, because he said he never even knew they'd done it.
Yeah.
The guy who wrote the books didn't know he'd done it. I don't know who owns the rights. Does Scholastic own the rights to those books? If so, they can legally do it. If they don't, they might be in legal trouble. So, but the point is, they can do that, and then you open your ebook reader, and the book's been changed. And they can do that.
So, Hiawatha, and first, the team wants to let me know, not the Beatles. It was with the Plastic Ono Band. Thank you very much. We have talked at other times about what happens when we take something, a thing, and we make it digital, right? It goes into the cloud or the ether. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you think about what we see in the future in the value of print, of books, if in fact they become sort of, and I'm overstating this on purpose, the sacred original text, right?
Well, I think what you're going to see is an increase in the respect and regard for printed books. Absolutely.
Isn't that interesting?
I think that's going to happen. And it's not just books. I know this is just coincidental. Just happened today to be reading a piece about what we might see is a growing backlash against the move to digital payments and digital currency. The United States is busily, like a lot of other countries, looking at the idea of doing central bank digital currency, where all our money would be totally digital. And everybody who's looking at this is starting to say, you know what that really means, right? That means the money all ultimately belongs to the government. And they can do just what they do with ebooks. They can go in and take charge of your money. They could actually do things like monitoring everything you buy. I mean, there's a big fuss. This is not quite the same thing, but Discover, the credit card company, recently said, we're going to track everybody who buys guns using a Discover card. And gun owners are furious about it. I don't care what you think about guns. They have a point. The idea that the banking system are going to now monitor your particular choice of what you buy. What happens if you buy abortion pills? What happens if you buy booze? What happens if you buy weed? Do we want the financial system tracking that?
So it's but a push to go back off the grid with
exactly.
cash.
And so more and more people are looking at that and saying, we got to get back to paper. We need to spend paper money or else we're going to have digital currencies being used as a constant social control means. And this digital book thing is just another version of that, perhaps a little less menacing, but wildly disturbing.
So this is Tech Talk with Hiawatha Bray here on Radio Boston. In a second, we're going to change the subject, but one more question on this, because, you, of course, mm-hmm. you've got my, as you always
right.
do, my brain's like, running, mm-hmm. thinking about all of this.
Sure.
So what we are looking at is the potential of kind of a bifurcation and a push for the off-the-grid, untrackable, unchangeable stuff.
Right, that's
versus
right.
Versus the on-the-grid,
paper
very
money,
fungible
printed books,
stuff.
Even vinyl. Look at the surge of interest
in
vinyl records.
Yeah.
It's mainly auditory, you know, because they think it has better audio quality. But I think this might further push that along. People are going to want the real original deal.
Interesting.
Before we leave the subject, though, we've got to mention an all-important fact. Turns out there is a defense against this, and I didn't even know you could do this with Kindle books. If you have Amazon Kindle, you can set your device and say, don't change my book.
Really? Like, this is my download. Don't touch
that's
it.
That's right. There is actually a setting that says, do not install automatic updates. Because it turns out that there have probably been all kinds of books you own that have been updated, but usually it's just fixing typos or something like that. There was a 2020 novel, science fiction novel, where somebody was upset about the way dreadlocks were described, and the author voluntarily said, I'm going to take that out, and she changed her book, and everybody's book copy got changed. It's disturbing, but at least it was really the author saying, I've changed my mind.
This
I'm not
is what
do
I
that.
Want. That's right,
right, exactly. So that's already happening. If you don't want it to happen, find the automatic updates feature, turn it off, and your books won't be fiddled with anymore.
All right, so I'm going to pivot now in our remaining time, Hiawatha, because when you came in today, you gave me a heads up that something that we've talked about quite a bit, which is the Massachusetts Right to Repair Law,
yep.
which has to do with repair information that's digitally produced by the car and can be transmitted and has been owned by the auto manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
You've got an update on that, so
well,
take
yeah,
us
the
there.
Update was that in 2020, Massachusetts residents, by a just gigantic margin, passed a referendum supporting a law that would require automakers to make this digital data available to the car owner and to anybody the car owner wanted to have access
so
to
their
it.
Local
in other words,
mechanics.
Independent auto mechanics, exactly. That law has been tied up in court ever since. Now, Attorney General Maura Healey agreed not to try to enforce the law, hoping that a federal judge would finally resolve this issue. This thing has been in court since summer of 2021. Nothing has come out of it. And our new Attorney General Campbell has said, forget this. It's over. I am going to start enforcing this law as of June the 1st. Automakers are going to have to start making this data available on their cars as of June the 1st this year. We don't know how the automaker is going to react. They refuse to comment on it. The people who support the law are just jumping up and down with glee. They're saying, hip, hip, hooray. It's going to raise all kinds of problems. And the automakers made this point in a court filing back in October. There is no system in place to do what the law requires. Nobody's built it yet. It would require the setting up of a whole separate new system to allow a car repair shop to plug into a single centralized source and get telematic data about every new car on the road.
So explain briefly, what is telematic data?
It's just basically all the diagnostic information about what's going on in your car, but now made available wirelessly and electronically so they can be transmitted directly to a car owner, to the car manufacturer, to a mechanic shop, anything. Having telematic access to this data would give the manufacturers a huge advantage because, for example, you're driving down the road, something goes wrong with your car, they know it before you do. It's being transmitted electronically to the manufacturer. These guys want to be competitive. They want to say, all right, suppose you want to transmit it to Midas or Jiffy Lube or somebody like that. We want a system whereby a customer could choose to share that information with us. So we get to call the customer and we get the business. It's not a bad idea. I mean, you understand it. Most people are in favor of it.
But she's going to start enforcing this.
Yeah.
June 1st.
June 1st.
But there's not actually any way to do it.
I don't, there's, nobody's built the system. Everybody agrees that the system for actually doing it does not exist. The National Highway, I forget the federal agency, back when this law was being debated, pointed out that doing this could raise huge cybersecurity problems. It has to be done just right, or people could end up hacking our cars. So it really is going to require a long-term strategy to figure out how to do it, and nobody's been trying to do it.
I think you're talking about the National Transportation and Highway Safety.
The National Highway Transportation
there
Safety.
There it is.
There it is. Yeah, and NHTSA. They
all right.
It.
Now that we've got that right, I think we should just call it. Hiawatha Bray, Boston Globe technology writer, comes in regularly every couple of weeks to give us tech talk. You bent our brains in a whole bunch of different ways today.
Isn't it awful?
No, it's always fantastic. I always leave Hiawatha, and for the next like 12 hours, I'm like, oh my gosh, and what about, and what about?
Yep.
Listen, thank you so
my
much.
My brain hurts. Okay.
Today, the second installment of producer Amanda Beland's journey to find out the origins of the name Chinese pie, a staple dish in Quebec and French-Canadian homes around New England. We brought you part one of Amanda's journey yesterday, and today, here's Amanda in part two of this Last Scene podcast from WBUR with how it turned out.
Taped to the wall in front of my desk are dozens of post-it notes, facts, and names that led me to my theory on the origin of Chinese pie. It should have been a relief, but I was still feeling totally stumped on why Chinese pie is called Chinese pie. That is, until I found Paul Marion.
Make sure your son knows about Chinese pie, pâté chinois, baked by your mémé.
That's Marion reading his poem called Chinese Pie from his collection What is the City? I found Paul Marion via Jack Kerouac, thanks again to my partner Elio. Let me explain. Elio suggested I look for clues through Jack Kerouac, the Franco-American poet from Lowell, Massachusetts. It was in that search that I came across Paul Marion, who edited Kerouac. And when I found Marion's poem Chinese Pie, it would blow the lid off my search.
In 1881, a politician labeled the Massachusetts French the Chinese of the Eastern States, industrial invaders, not a stream of stable settlers.
Could it really be that simple that the name Chinese pie comes from the phrase Chinese of the Eastern States? To suss out that theory, we have to go deep into the French-Canadian story in New England. Between 1840 and 1930, roughly 900,000 French-Canadians made the journey to the region.
They were coming down in families. If they didn't know somebody already in the town, they might live with another French-Canadian family just before they can get their bearings. They would immediately get jobs in the mills.
That's Sarah Deary of the New England Historic Genealogy Society. Her specialty is in French-Canadian ancestry professionally, but also she has French-Canadian roots herself. Life was tough for these immigrants. Men, women, and children worked long hours in the mills where they earned very little money. My grandfather and his siblings all worked in shoe factories, doing various jobs in Manchester. When it came down to eating, Deary said it was all about convenience.
We have a family story that my grandmother would buy 1 pound of meat a week, and she had to stretch that for five individuals for 5 days. And by the end of the week, you have a bunch of leftovers and you just kind of throw them all together into a casserole.
These Franco-Americans lived in areas known as Little Canadas, where they closed themselves off to American culture. There, they spoke French and kept their customs. David Vermette writes about New England's French in his book, A Distinct Alien Race, The Untold Story of Franco-Americans, Industrialization, Immigration, Religious Strife.
They were very much into the idea that they would remain a separate group, loyal to the United States, working for the United States, and yet separate. And this comes from their background in Canada.
Starting in 1763, Canada was under British rule. In Quebec, these French speakers resisted assimilating into British society, fighting strongly to keep their language and their customs. That nationalistic resistance became known as La Survivance.
This was an ideology. You know, it was something that was strong. It was promoted by French-Canadian elites and Franco-American elites by their priests, by their journalists, by the professionals and educated people among them.
But here in New England, they were met with even stronger pressure to assimilate, viewed with skepticism, in part because of the Roman Catholicism.
They did crazy things like having these huge religious processions with hundreds and thousands of people, you know, through these industrial towns with the priests in full regalia with big crosses and incense, and they're marching through the streets. And the majority Yankee population was like, what's this? What, this is totally weird. You know, what are these people doing?
And it's in this powder keg that someone lights a match. And that person was Carol D. Wright, director of the Massachusetts Bureau of Labor Statistics. Wright is looking into the merit of a law that would restrict the workday to 10 hours. He gets intel from informants that French Canadians are resisting the change. This builds on the growing skepticism of these Canucks in the community. So he notes that resistance in his 1881 report. David Vermette reads some of that for me.
With some exceptions, the Canadian French are the Chinese of the Eastern States. They care nothing for our institutions, civil, political, or educational. They
are a whole. The phrase Chinese of the Eastern States is both racist against Franco-Americans and the Chinese. It draws on anti-Chinese rhetoric happening in the U.S. and, as you'll remember, in Canada too at this time. A year after the 1881 report, the U.S. would pass its own Chinese Exclusion Act. The phrase Chinese of the Eastern States also catches on beyond New England. A few months later, the New York Times repeats the slur in an editorial. In that piece, they say of Franco-Americans, they are, for the most part, ignorant and unenterprising, subservient to the most bigoted class of Catholic priests in the world, a peasantry belonging more to the 18th than the 19th century. To say the local Franco-American community is incensed by the report would be an understatement.
The various French-Canadian clubs and societies and the Little Canadas wrote to the state legislature, and they tried to refute this report, and there was even hearings in Boston where French-Canadian witnesses came forward to try to claim that they were loyal citizens and good workers.
But it's too late. That report by Carol Wright has a domino effect, crystallizing racism against a group now feared and hated by many in New England. A portion of the report, using the phrase Chinese of the Eastern States, is even read into the record at a labor hearing on the Senate floor in 1883. At the same time, a conspiracy theory starts to form about Franco-Americans.
You have, you know, reputable newspapers like the New York Times, for one, they're spreading these conspiracy theories that the Catholic Church had deliberately sent these French-Canadian workers into New England in a bid to take over New England.
David Vermette says he found no evidence of this, but it still spreads and even leads to people trying to ban the French language from being taught or spoken in schools. This period of time was when my French-Canadian family, like so many others, were trying to make a home in New England. It's really hard thinking about them living and working in these times. Despite all of this, immigration to New England from Quebec doesn't slow down. In fact, it speeds up, and the growing community keeps fighting.
They were used to that idea that we're going to build a fence and we're going to fight. So I think that's what they did.
This fighting and prejudice continues throughout the early 20th century. Franco-Americans become targets of the eugenics movement and of the second rise of the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan was headquartered in Maine in 1924, and research shows there were regular attacks and shows of force against Franco-Americans. And this brings me back to Chinese pie. Here's a dish prevalent in this community. It makes sense to me that they would take back a name used against them and turn it into a rallying cry. You're trying to drive us out, but you can't. It's also possible the name was given to the dish by the outside, but adopted for the same reasons as that rallying cry. A dish that came down from Quebec now has a name that travels back up home through generations. A big middle finger to the majority elite. Here's Paul Marion again with his poem Chinese Pie.
Attacked for loyalty to culture, the Canucks counterpunched, and the next government report was kinder. You can order pâté chinois in Montreal. One recipe the emigrants sent back.
Marion said he wrote the poem for a friend's son to preserve the memory of the dish. Like me, Chinese pie for him was just a given for most of his life. He didn't think much about it until he started writing his poem. For him, this is just a theory. And that's what this is for me, too. There's no documented, definitive history of Chinese pie. But this history here is what makes the most sense to me. I only became interested in my family's story in my 30s. But by then, it was almost too late. Both sets of my grandparents had died. And my mom passed away when I was in college. My dad's memories of his family are what I have as mine. I can't begrudge younger Amanda for not having the foresight to ask questions about how my mom grew up.
Say, I love you, Mommy.
I love you, Mommy.
You're a special, Mommy.
I'm so special, Mommy.
Daddy's gonna film Mommy and Amanda?
Or what it was like for my grandparents.
Can you do it again?
Mame. Give a nice kiss to Mame.
Low kisses for Mame.
You like that, Mame? That's for my girl.
The best thing I can do now is make sure my future family knows all of this history, that I pass down my memories and my family's memories to them, that I pass down Chinese pie.
All right, so we're going to put this in the oven?
Yes.
Let's do bottom shelf and then we'll do broiler at the end.
Agreed.
Let's do 30 minutes.
Ooh, not 40 minutes.
Okay.
And go.
That was Amanda Beeland, who reported and produced this episode of Last Scene with Nora Sachs and the WBUR podcast team. To hear more WBUR podcasts, go to wbur.org/podcasts. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Amanda Beeland and Rob Lane, with Bart Tocci and John Bender. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director with help from Renee Marchando. Titus Folladoon is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.